Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
This is a podcast from BBC Studios, the commercial subsidiary of the BBC.
Hello and welcome back to Season 2 of the TalentWorks podcast. If you haven't listened to us before, TalentWorks is a production company within BBC Studios, and it's aimed at identifying forward-thinking talent with whom it can partner. The podcast is presented by Helen O'Donnell and me, Brona Monaghan. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to subscribe. Taha Khan is a content creator, writer, and producer. He makes online comedy videos both for his eponymous YouTube channel and is known for his heartbreaking stop-motion music videos for artists such as Cave Town. Taha was also one of the original members of YouTube's Creators for Change, a program set up to support creators with big ideas to help counter xenophobia, extremism, and hate with stories that promote positive change. Taha took part in our first collaboration with the BBC Writers' Room, and so we were excited to sit down with him and find out what he learnt and where his newfound comedy toolkit has taken him since. Hi, Taha.
Hello.
Thanks for coming into the TalentWorks podcast studio today.
Thanks.
We haven't actually been together since May,
yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
When we went away for the writers' room retreat. Yeah. Well, it's good to get you back.
Thanks.
We really wanted to sort of reflect on that retreat. Talk about some of the things that you learned, but also just to talk more about you as a creator, because you were the youngest of the group. So you're really an internet baby.
I guess so. I don't see myself as that, because that's all I've known, but I guess I am.
Can you tell us sort of what did the internet mean to you growing up? Was it always a source of entertainment? Is that where you consume content?
Yeah, definitely. I think when I was growing up, I think I really remember when the internet really came into my life, because we had one computer in the house, and like as a kid, I got like 15 minutes on it every day. So my 15 minutes was like Club Penguin.
What's Club Penguin?
Oh, wow. Okay. Club Penguin is like a... It's like a... I don't even know how to describe it.
Your face looked then like, oh my gosh, they are so elderly.
I've never had to explain Club Penguin to anyone. It's like a RPG. So it's a role-playing game where you are a penguin and you walk around doing like little mini games, and there are other penguins who are other people, and you can chat to them. I really don't know how to describe it.
You learn something new every day.
Yeah. But it was huge. It was the thing to be playing at the time.
So it was gaming, kind of. Is that how
first... It was like I would be gaming with my friends. Like, yeah. you would play mini games, and then you could like, you would win things that you could like put in your igloo, which was like where you put your trophies or whatever. I'm butchering that explanation. but then like the first time I started consuming content was when I got the first iPod Touch. And so my interface with the internet was purely through my iPod Touch, which was the YouTube app. And like the first series I ever watched was called Red versus Blue, which is the longest running web series of all time. And it was basically a sitcom that was based in a video game. So it was Machinima. Do you know what Machinima is?
Is it a gaming company?
It is now, but before it was... It came from like machine and cinema, so it was people using games to animate little stories. So they would use like Halo, for example, and like bob the character's heads up and down.
So they were really ahead of the curve.
But it was like, now after going to the writer's room, I like retroactively now recognize it as a very traditional sitcom.
Okay.
But it was like set in space, because Halo was a space game. And it was just really funny to me, because it was all these like internet jokes, and like that was my like Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. That was like what I would go back every week and like make sure there's like what the new episode is like, the thing I'd rush home from school to watch. So that like that was almost pre-YouTube in my head, because they published on a site called Rooster Teeth. They didn't actually publish on YouTube itself. And then I started discovering more content creators, Ryan Heger, Dan Howell, who was on the writer's retreat. So I would definitely say that like my first sort of foray into like a lot of content mm-hmm. consumption was definitely through my Upper Touch.
And during that time growing up, when did you realize you were creative?
I never saw myself as a creative person. Growing up, I was really academically gifted, and so I was like, "Oh, I'm the like academic one." All I knew was that I wasn't the sporty one, because that's what my brother was. And so I was like, "Oh, I'm the academic one." And then I started after Red versus Blue, which was the web series based in Halo. I made a channel making gaming videos, and then that like didn't go very far because I didn't have an Xbox, so I was actually just ripping people's footage from YouTube, cutting it up in different ways and putting it up as montages. So at that point I didn't really think that was creative. I was just kind of like messing around with editing and things. After that I had a dance channel where I would do body popping in my back garden. And again, that didn't feel creative because it was like, oh, I'm just kind of dancing around to things. But then I had a video, I think it was a Taylor Swift song. It was, I Knew You Were Trouble, mm-hmm. whatever that song was. That like didn't go viral, but it got like 100,000 views.
Which
is really good.
Yeah, you're like, it didn't go viral, but you're also saying 100,000 views. It's phenomenal.
It wasn't like everyone didn't know who I was, you know, like the BBC wasn't knocking on my door to write a profile on me. But it definitely like was a lot of people. And I was 14.
Describe the video.
Oh, it was just me in my garden and I was just dancing and the song was playing. And it's not great or anything. I think it was just like, I made it just as the song came out, so people were searching for the song, and like, you know, it was like right place, right time kind of thing.
Yeah.
I was 14 or 15 at the time, got very scared and deleted my channel because I was like, oh, my parents are going to find out. I don't want to, like, I was just so scared of the internet and like all of that. So I deleted my channel and like all the videos are gone. And then a couple years later, when I was older, I like talked to my parents being like, oh, I want to do YouTube. And like, they were like, all right, that's fine. As long as your grades are fine. So it was one summer just after school had finished. I like started making weekly videos. And then that's when I was like, I had the confidence to like, be like, I think I'm funny. And I think I can make videos like, the people at the time were like Ryan Heger, Dan Howell, and Humza Productions, from like he was doing his Diary of a Bad Man series. I think Humza Productions was like the first time that I saw someone like brown and British be like, oh, I can be funny. Like that's something that you can do as a brown person.
You see, it's really hard. I mean, being young, a Muslim, a Pakistani, British citizen, it's all very confusing. Like my Uncle Taj's moustache. Yeah. So anyway, let me get straight to the point, yeah? I'm a Don. I'm perfect. I'm amazing. I'm freaking fantastic. And I'm humble too.
And so that was the moment where I was like, oh, okay, like, I really like this type of humour and, like, there are other brown people that are doing this. And I was like, all right, I can do this too. And then, yeah, started making comedy.
And what was your sort of creative flow? Was it each week I'm going to think of something new, or were you planning it out weeks in advance?
Definitely just like make a video, then the next idea would come. Like it was the first, I think you get into a honeymoon phase when you first start YouTube and you're just so excited that like you can make whatever you like. that I was just like, and it, I had the whole summer and I basically had no friends. I lived like in a village outside of Cambridge. So all of my friends were in Cambridge. And so like, I really couldn't see them as often as they were seeing each other. So I really just could just make YouTube videos, and I would just like make a YouTube video and immediately come up with another idea. And they weren't great. I went back and watched them recently in preparation for this, kind of. And I still laugh at them. I think that like the joke, the comedy beats are there, but like I don't think I, you know, they're not something I would want anyone else to see.
Everyone needs to start somewhere, though.
Yeah, I'm really proud of where I started, because when I go back and watch other people's first video, I'm like, my first video is better than this first video. But yeah.
I think your comedy, you have a very sensitive approach to comedy. Like, I like quite sentimental comedy, and I like social commentary. The reason we came across your channel because of, I can't pronounce his name, my accent butchers it, Dave
is a racist?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes.
Tell us a bit about that video.
Yeah, so Dave is a Racist is a stop motion, like quite dry, short filmy sort of sketch, which actually started because I was like a insecure boy who wanted to continue making videos but had a really big spot on his nose. And I was like, oh no, well, I don't want to be on camera, so what can I do? So I made a sketch called, I can't quite remember what it was called, but it was like something dumb like Callum Wants to Fly or something. It was like in the same sort of comedy structure as Dave's a Racist. And I did a stop motion thing because literally I had a spot on my nose and I didn't want to show my face on camera. But Dave is a Racist is basically a sketch about a guy who is really into maths and hates all other subjects. And it's like a parallel between like him loving maths and him being a white nationalist. It's a very sort of like absurdist sort of.
But it stood out. It really stood out.
Thank you.
I think that, I mean, when we were going through people that we were really keen to bring on the retreat, we wanted people who were very unique. And I think sometimes there is a tendency on YouTube to feel like you have to fit into a certain trend. And in comedy, the most important thing is your tone of voice. Mm-hmm. And your video was just so unique to you. Even the combinations of the stop motion.
Thank you.
For you, that was a kind of fulfilling a need because you didn't want to be on camera, but actually it was that little element of it that just made it pop a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to talk about the stop motion
project
that you worked on with Cave Town.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
So Cave Town is a artist who makes like acoustic pop music. He is also someone that I met at school. And he came up with an album called Lemon Boy. One of the songs on it was called Green, and it was my favorite song. And so I was just like, you have to let me make a music video to this song. And so he was like, yeah, go ahead, do whatever you like. Little did he know that I was going to make a stop motion project that was going to last 3 months. So I got one of my friends, Guy Larson, who is a very experienced filmmaker, stop motion guy. He's done music videos for Dodi. He's done stuff for Instagram. Like, he's a big shot. I had met him like once before, but I was really excited to get other people who were excited about stop motion. We talked about it, and we just spent 3 months in a basement, stop motion animating this like weird music video about a lemon, a lime, and an orange who are like alive and like fall in love, and one of them dies, and
it's very tragic.
Yeah, it's very tragic. I was really surprised by the fact that in my head it was more funny than it was tragic. But then when we started animating it and when we started like storyboarding it was like, oh, this is actually a really heartfelt, sad story, and it's not funny at all.
Tell us more about what happens in it, because it is beautiful.
Yeah.
So, the concept of it's like giving yourself, isn't it, to other people?
Yeah. The song is about kind of letting someone kind of move on and knowing that you're not right for them, and they can build a life with someone else, essentially, I think. And so the story is basically a lemon and a lime who have a relationship that's kind of unspecified. You know, it's not necessarily romantic, but one, the lime is giving way more to the relationship than the lemon. And then the lemon gets frustrated that the lime isn't giving more. So the lemon leaves, and the lime finds a more healthy relationship with the orange. And you can see why this would be funny, right? It's like so stupid. And then the lemon like realizes that what they had was so great, and like wants to give back, but just before they can, they get eaten by a massive turtle. And then the lime discovers that and like buries the lemon, and that's kind of the end of it. And so,
but the depiction of it through like giving too much to yourself is depicted through juicing.
Yeah. It's like they pour like lemon juice and lime juice and hand them to each other. So all of it was like really, really stupid in my head. I'm like, oh, add some more like ridiculousness to this, and like it was so funny to see my initially very, very funny idea, very cartoonish idea. Guy has like a very sort of dark direction that he usually takes things, and he's a really heartfelt storyteller. So, you know, the combination of the two like really, really like made this really, really tragic thing.
Well, one of the things that we learned was that comedy and tragedy are so, yeah, there's a very, very fine line.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I'm writing something right now that's whenever I pitch it to people laugh, but it's like there's no jokes in it, which is like I'm telling the story of a family but only through their toothbrushes. And like every time I tell the story, everyone's like, oh, that's really funny. Like, that's going to be such a interesting way of doing it. But like, I'm like, oh no, you're going to cry. Like this is not going to be funny at all. But my writing always comes from a place of making something really funny. Mm-hmm. But then it goes wherever it goes.
So tell us a little bit more about, let's talk about the writer's room. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear, first of all, what you enjoyed about it. I'd love to hear sort of the highlights, because we did a few different sort of concepts and workshopped a few different elements of comedy. Tell me first, what was your favourite part? What did you enjoy the most?
What did I enjoy the most? I think that what I enjoyed the most was like having all of these realisations as someone who's like the youngest and like hasn't done anything, like hasn't had a traditional sort of, I haven't studied comedy or drama or theatre or writing or filmmaking or anything. I think there are a lot of sort of like realisations that I had of like, oh, that's how things happen, or like just like the way sitcoms are written, or like the way improv happens. All of these things really felt really nebulous and inaccessible to mm-hmm. me. So there was a lot of like, what I enjoyed the most was just someone who has done this for a really long time coming down and whatever their respective area was, just like explaining how it works in like very plain ways, because now I can like actually sit and watch a sitcom and see the mechanics of it and like be like, okay, how would I alter these mechanics and like how would I do that? I think a lot of the time I'd be like, oh, it would be really cool if I could write a sitcom, but like I don't even know how to start.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
What I really loved was finding out that no one's original and that, like, it's all about your voice. Like, I think that learning that was, like, such a it reassured me to no end, because I was, like, trying to be, like, one of a kind is so glorified, especially now where everyone can be, there's no gatekeepers, so, like, everyone's trying to be new and unique, but it's like, oh, you already are unique, you know? It's like, it was really nice to kind of discover that.
Well, the thing is, everyone's got a unique perspective and different life experience, so it's trying to distill your perspective into that framework.
I just can never stop thinking of, you know, Ursula in The Little Mermaid when she's like, I just want your voice. It's like, that's it, isn't it? That's all you can ask for somebody.
Yeah.
That they've got a really unique voice and that they're willing to share it with people.
Yeah.
Because everything can be taught in terms of structure, or like you say, like improv, or like even topical joke writing, like how to write a joke in two lines. All that can be taught, but your unique perspective on the world cannot be.
Yeah.
And then since we last saw you in May, you've actually been to VidCon, where Helen was a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And you did some stand-up.
I did some stand-up.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So...
have you done stand-up before?
That was my third time ever.
Okay.
So for context, that was in front of, what, 750 people?
Yeah. When we say, like, stand-up, we're not thinking, like, a tiny room in the back of a pub. So, also for context, what is VidCon?
Oh, yes. VidCon is a video convention that was set up by the Vlogbrothers. It's like YouTube Christmas.
Yeah.
Everyone's
it's like
there.
The Comic-Con of YouTube.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's a better way of describing it. It feels like YouTube Christmas. Everyone's there. Like, all of these really cool creators are there. Everyone's really excited about what everyone else is kind of doing. There was a huge TikTok presence this year, which was really exciting. I got to learn about what the hell's happening on TikTok. It really feels like every year everyone comes together and, like, shares ideas and, like, has a really great time, and then everyone has, like, a new lease of life on, like, on what can be done on the internet.
I agree. I think you would struggle to come away with that not inspired by something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether it was a new way of editing, or a new way of telling your story, or a new way of, I don't know, cutting your content down, is inspiring on all levels.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so great to be in a place, especially because, like, creating content on the internet is such a solitary thing. Being with other people who just get it, and you don't have to, like, do the pretense of, like, okay, so YouTube, it's like,
what do you do?
Yeah,
what is that? Yeah.
Just being like, oh, I get it. Like, don't even worry about it.
It's like a shortcut.
Yeah, and, like, you can actually get into the discussions of that you have with yourself all of the time, but with other people. And especially as a creator, hanging out with other creators is always, like, they are going through the same struggles, but some of them are, like, 10 years down the line in terms of their journey. Like, someone like Hank, talking to him, who's, like, set up, like, four companies, and, you know, for context, he's the one who started VidCon. But, like, talking to him about things, like, he has such a great perspective. But then also talking to, like, a TikToker who's just started and has this huge excitement that you, like, I had when I did, like, when I started with my first ever video. And it's so cool to have both of those perspectives interacting and, like, having that be, like, the inspiration be the synthesis of all of those conversations. It's just a really exciting place.
Your stand-up at VidCon. Oh,
yeah.
So, picture the scene. We're in a room. There's probably, like, 750 people there. It's a conference room, but it's got low lighting, so you do feel like you're in a comedy club.
Mm.
Taha takes to the stage.
Yes. I had no material on purpose. I had an opening joke just to make sure that, like, I had something. And then I just had to fill 10 minutes, I think it was. And the reason I went on with no material was just because currently I'm just working on my stage presence. I was in America, so any of the jokes that I would start developing in America, I wouldn't want to use in the UK, because my humour is very British in its kind of delivery. It's very awkward, it's very subtle, and Americans just don't really gel with that. They really need to be kind of... hit over the head with the punchline, or like they're more used to laughing at traditional comedy structures, and so deconstructing that in front of them isn't going to work every time. So I was just working on my stage presence, and so it's a blur for me. Like, I don't remember anything I said.
I was going to say, how did it feel?
I felt much better than the first time I did it, which was 1 year ago on that stage. So the first time I ever did stand up was in front of 750 people on that stage again. And I had material from my Twitter, which was just, I just got some funny things that I've said in the past, and I said, I know these work, I'm just going to say them. And that went well, but the one note I got was my stage presence wasn't great. So this time I was just like, okay, stage presence, let's just work on stage presence. But I don't remember most of what happened. It really felt like I went on and then I came off, and it was just like people laughed in the interim, but like, yeah, it was very like, as soon as I came off, I was like, I could do another 10 minutes. Like I really was just like, I need another, like, I think I'm hooked now. Now I've signed up for every open mic in London. They're all on like waiting lists and stuff. So,
are you going to do the same thing? No material? Or are you?
I think I'm good with no material now.
Okay.
I think that like everyone said my stage presence was good. I think I need jokes now. And now that I'm in the UK, I'm like hoping to like really write. If I can get like one 5 minute slot every night, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I can practice my 5 minutes, write 5 minutes, get it really clean, and then work on another 5 minutes. And like in 6 weeks, I could potentially have 30 minutes.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, that's so
cool.
Are you
going to test stuff on YouTube? You going to put anything on?
I'm going to put the whole special on YouTube. Okay. Like if I was to make a special, I think that like, I so believe that like people want to watch stand-up comedy on YouTube. I think the fact that Netflix has taken a lot of the stand-up comedy stuff is like such a tragedy for YouTube, because everyone used to like, that was the original kind of thing that people used to do on YouTube, is watch
up,
stand-up
though.
Clips.
What the industry would say, well, I'm not speaking for the whole of the industry. Netflix have taken them essentially from DVDs. DVDs used to be the way that people watch stand-up. So if you think like Peter Kay back in the day, Michael McIntyre, John Bishop, all those kind of traditional stand-ups, they went from selling hundreds of thousands on DVD, and now Netflix have picked it up. I think so. What's interesting is you're coming out from...
How I consume stand-up is 5 minute clips on YouTube.
Yeah.
And the fact that like YouTube has a YouTube premium service and they're not doing what Netflix are doing. Like they're literally not funding like
comedians
which
yeah.
is ridiculous to me, because I think that my generation, all they want to do is watch short, funny clips.
Colleen's has been picked up by Netflix, hasn't it?
Yeah, and she's literally a YouTuber. Like, surely YouTube would have wanted to... I don't know. Yeah, we don't really know what happened there, but like, in my head, I'm like, I want... One of the people I really look up to is Bo Burnham, and he put his whole special on Netflix. On, what's it? YouTube. yeah. and that's how I discovered Bo Burnham. I just watched this whole special on YouTube, and I think more like young comedians should just be like filming 10 minute sets and just putting them on YouTube. And the fact that that's not happening is like really sad to me.
So Bo Burnham's a great example of somebody who's gone from YouTube to long form director. He wrote Eighth Grade, which was phenomenal. I feel like we've not touched with you just on this conversation about all the other things you do.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to just very quickly talk about the...
Everything else.
Just the everything else.
Okay. So I was a creative director for Cave Town. So I did a couple of his music videos and just generally his art direction for a while. I ran the panels. I was panels coordinator at Summer in the City, which is our version of VidCon. By our, I mean the UK. So I did that for 3 years. That was when I was like 17, 18, 19. And then what else do I do? I'm a university student, so I'm doing politics, philosophy and economics at university. And then I helped write some like educational entertainment stuff with like various channels and just like kind of helping people grow their own projects on YouTube. Kind of, I did some consulting stuff with people launching Patreons, kind of like just to get myself really in the teeth of the industry and like making sure that I understand everything. So I've done a little bit of everything outside of that. And then I have my own channel that was mainly comedy with like a political twist. My main platform, I would say, I would arguably, is Twitter. I love Twitter. I think that it's such like a dark horse as a platform. I think really cool and interesting things have been happening on that platform for years, and I think that people are still screenshotting things from Twitter and putting them on Facebook and Instagram.
What's next for you?
What is next for me? I am going into my final year of university, which is the most boring thing out of all of the things I think that are going to be next for me, but that's meant that like I've seriously been thinking about what I want to do post-university. And so one of the things I really want to do is working on stand-up. Being on tour with Cave Town for a couple of tours has really like got that bug of like traveling and like working in me. So I've just come back from America, which I was there for a month and a half. And I would love to be able to like just travel the UK and do comedy. And then I am writing a couple of short films. I am really, really hoping after like doing YouTube and having that lead to a bunch of opportunities, doing all of those like Summer in the City and Cave Town and things like that, I really want to go back to YouTube and build something. Not of significance, because I think that I think that everything I've done so far is also of significance. However, I think that I've never like really truly tried to cultivate an audience for my own voice, and I would love to do that. So like I'm really hoping to do things on my own YouTube and put my own stamp on it and like have my own creative control on everything. So I'm really in a place of like inflection where I'm finished a bunch of projects and I'm about to start like a whole new chapter of like being on YouTube and doing my own thing.
It sounds really exciting, and I love the fact that you've already booked in all of these shows. Like, you need to cut your teeth in comedy.
Yeah.
I think doing all of those open mics, that's kind of the birth.
Yeah,
the birth of Dagon. That's what you should call your show.
I'm excited for it. I think it could be a thing of like in 3 weeks, I'm like, oh yeah, comedy wasn't for me. So this podcast would age really badly. But or it could be a thing. It's like this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. But I'm really in a place of like everything that I have been doing and everything that I'm about to do are like quite different because I think that I've spent a lot of time focusing on building things for other people, and that was a really great way of like honing my skills in producing and writing. And I have never given myself permission to write something for myself. And I think being at the writer's retreat really helped with that. I think it was kind of clear during the writer's retreat that I had a lot of imposter syndrome and I didn't feel like I belonged there. And I think that that was mainly because I wasn't giving myself permission to write and be good enough to be my own voice. So I'm kind of just working on that, I think, for the next year.
You definitely need to give yourself more credit.
Thanks.
We believe in you.
Yeah.
Well, we loved having you as part of the Writers' Retreat. And we're very excited to see these next videos coming out. And hopefully we can come and see one of your shows in London.
Ooh. Pressure's on.
Thanks, Dara.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to find out more about us, we're on Instagram at BBC Studios Talentworks.
This podcast is produced by Shola Aleje for BBC Studios.